Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Tulsa Ballet returns with one of its most popular and important full-length ballets to the stage this weekend as they present Lady of the Camellias by choreographer Val Canaparoli. The 1994 ballet was first presented by the company in 2000 and later performed at the Ballet Nights Festival in Portugal that helped cement the company's international reputation. Lady of the Camellias is based on the 1848 novel by Alexandre Dumas and follows the love affair of the courtesan Marguerite and the noble Armand, who tries to distance her from her past. The story has inspired at least 20 movies, from Greta Garbo's Camille to Baz Luhrmann's Moulin Rouge and Giuseppe Verdi's opera La Traviata. My guest today is choreographer Val Canaparoli. This was his first full-length ballet and continues to be one of his most popular. Canaparoli has created about 75 ballets and contributed to the repertoires of more than 45 ballet companies, from his own San Francisco Ballet, where he continues to dance character roles, to Boston Ballet, Ballet West, the Joffrey Ballet, and of course Tulsa Ballet, where he was resident choreographer from 2001 to 2006. All told, Tulsa Ballet has performed 9 of Canaparoli's ballets over the years. And they present Lady of the Camellias this weekend for 3 performances, Friday and Saturday at 8, Sunday afternoon at 3 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Val Canaparoli joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Val Canaparoli, welcome back to Studio Tulsa, and welcome back to Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great being back here. I always love coming here.
This has been a really fruitful relationship with the company. Now, you're no longer the resident choreographer, haven't been for a number of years, but what's it like coming back to Tulsa to do one of these favorites that, you know, the company loves, and it has to be one of your favorite ballets as well? Well,
it's always great to come back to a company you've worked with a lot before. There's a lot of the dancers have changed, but Marcello hasn't. Marcello Angelini, artistic director, and I've known him and his wife for many years, and there's still a lot of familiar faces, so it's like coming back home, actually, and I love coming to Tulsa. Love working with the company. They're wonderful. Always a great atmosphere. They're great collaborators. They're, you know, it's so, I can't do wrong with this company. I really love it.
What's it like to see a dancer, you know, you come to someplace, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years, and then you come back and you see that same dancer, and obviously that dancer is no longer the same. And you know, maybe sometimes they blossom into something spectacular. Is that, I would think that would be kind of a really interesting situation.
Right, it is interesting. And it's, I think the biggest transition that I see that's different is when that dancer has gone on to roles beyond dancing, you know, whether it be PR, public relations management, or are working as coaches and such. So it's great to see them giving back, and I love that aspect of it. And many times when I come back to a company, particularly this one with dancers I've worked with before, they're even better. They're more mature, and so I love that as well.
And it's interesting you say that, because this is something that's been an important part of your own life, because even though you could probably live as a freelance choreographer, and probably do, you still dance with San Francisco Ballet doing character roles.
Yeah, what I love about it is I don't forget what it's like. I'm in there and rehearsing with the other dancers, getting yelled at like them, you know, getting criticized, getting corrections, and it keeps me more grounded. I don't forget what it's like. I know many choreographers and many other, they forget what it's like. And when I'm choreographing for them, I know their problems. I know what's going on. So it gives me a better perspective. It keeps me a little more honest, I think.
I think it would. Just the idea of sharing the sweat, you know, the sweat equity.
Exactly,
because it is hard work. Mm-hmm. Even character roles. Dancing in high heels for Cinderella, for example. Well, take us back to when you created Lady of the Camellias. This was your first full-length ballet. What went into the decision to do this particular story as your first full-length? Because you'd done a lot of one-act ballets prior to that, and so this was a big step for you.
Well, it was by accident, to be honest. My first teacher and then my first director ever gave me a job, Norbert Wiesack, with San Francisco Opera, Opera Ballet. Mm-hmm. I was with them prior to San Francisco Ballet. He choreographed all over the world, and I remember I was choreographing at the time, and I saw he and his partner at the airport on their way from San Francisco to New York to buy fabrics for this project called Lady of the Camellias for Ballet Florida. And he showed me the designs and such, and I thought that was amazing. And lo and behold, what happened in New York airport coming back after they had bought all the fabrics and such, he died of a brain aneurysm.
Oh, my gosh.
So the project was shelved for 2 years. And so his partner in Ballet Florida came to me and said, would you take over? Would you be interested in this? And I said, well, absolutely, as a tribute to Norbert. Absolutely said yes. And as long as I can switch out some of the music, change the scenario, change a lot of things. There wasn't any choreography yet. So mm-hmm. I really started fresh, even though the designs were there. Designs are finished. We added, subtracted, whatever. But that really was by accident. But what is great, Camille, the Greta Garbo film, was one of my favorite films ever, so I was familiar with it. And I didn't start dancing until I was 20. And in college, I played Armand on stage as an actor. So I knew the story very, very well. So it just was like, this was meant to be, really meant to be.
Would that have been your first choice for a full length, do you think?
Probably not. Probably not. So I love happy surprises like this. I love challenges, too. So that was definitely a challenge on something that's been started as already, but to make it your own. And even, I believe it was 1994, I think the premiere was. But since then, the ballet has changed drastically. It's even different than when we did it here last. There's some new music inserted. There's probably been, since its premiere in 1994, a good 45 minutes shaved off the ballet.
Yeah. Now, is that something you usually do, tinker with a ballet after it's created?
Yeah, I think definitely yes. Even Balanchine tinkered with all his masterpieces until his death. I think it's natural. We tend to forget ballet does not, like movies and theater and Broadway, have trial runouts, previews. You know, we don't get to edit before we formally open, and we're weird to have geniuses with a one day on stage and put on a new work. You know, it's almost impossible. And in fact, it is impossible.
So when when you see the reaction for the audience, you say, okay, that works, that doesn't.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And that's why Broadway shows take it out in previews on the road before they take it to Broadway or the London stages. And movies, too. They have previews. And sometimes they don't do the scheduled opening for 6-7 months because they got to do all these tweaks. We don't have that resources, the money, whatever. And so, like I said, if you're lucky enough, if a ballet survives that opening night, that's when the real work starts. That's when you really sit back. And I've been tweaking all of my ballets, even though everyone goes, why are you doing this? It's fine. I said, no, it's not fine. You know, it's still.
So that was my next question. There is getting it right, mm-hmm. and tinkering.
Yeah, exactly.
It sounds like you're a tinkerer.
And even here, I've changed things dramatically. Even if it's a gesture, even if the sound effect was like, whoa, that's been going on for 20 years. Why did I miss this? And that's what I mean. It just really, really does help the production. It makes it streamlines it. And
now, are you a choreographer that does your own work when you set a ballet, especially like this, that's been around for a number of years? You set it yourself, or do you have assistants now?
I have probably 10 people that go out throughout the world and stage my works.
Well, that makes it different if you're always messing with it.
Oh, yeah, because you got to, sometimes that then it'll take forever. You know, you want it staged, you want it, which is teaching the steps, mm-hmm. and then you can go back. That's the easy part. Here, I had incredible help with Danielle Boussin.
They have their own history with the ballet.
And Susan, who staged the work for me, and Danielle, who performed the work, probably was one of the best Marguerites that have ever performed this work. And so I was lucky to have her. And Alfonso Martin, he was like there as well, and he was in the production. You know, some of the dancers that have been in the past were also helpful. So I was very lucky in that way where it came together.
When you have a cast that is familiar with the ballet, does that give you sort of a higher starting point, or can it be detrimental?
It's definitely a higher starting point.
So you can really refine the characters a little bit.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. Well, for those who are not familiar with the story of Lady of the Camellias, this has been done in, what, probably 100 movies?
this plot.
it's probably best known for devotees of the arts as the story of La Traviata.
Right.
Marguerite is the courtesan with the Baron. She falls in love with a nobleman. The nobleman's father comes to her and says, you got to break this off. Mm-hmm. You're dying anyway. You have consumption. Mm-hmm. You're going to ruin my family name. Mm-hmm. So she does the honorable thing. Armand becomes furious and takes up with another. And eventually they get into a duel between the Baron and Armand. And Marguerite's left alone. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, normal life. Yeah. It's definitely that's what it is.
So give us a sense of some of the choices you made in portraying this story.
I think this ballet, the ending is probably one of the favorite endings I've ever done with the ballet. And mind you, it's telling stories without saying words. We don't have that luxury. So you have the physicality of the body to portray your character. In this case, Marguerite at the end, which is so unusual for a ballet, the last 5 minutes of ballet, there's not one ballet step. And everyone said, you can't do that. That's cheeky. They'll hate it. It's one of my favorite endings of all time, where she's just sitting at the desk looking at herself in the mirror right before she dies. I mean, it's heartbreaking, you know. And so sometimes simplicity is best, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Now that decision, that does go against type. I mean, you think of, you know, Romeo and Juliet. You know, Juliet dances her way into the grave. So does Romeo, you know.
She's dead and he's dancing with her, presumably dead. And it's like, really? Okay. But I mean, it's you know, that's fine too. But in this case, it just, the original story that Norbert did was not like that. And I immediately went, I don't know why, that was one of the first things I did. It was like, no.
She's going to die
alone. And that's pretty much how it is.
Well, that puts a lot of pressure on Marguerite, because Marguerite has to basically establish that whatever it is the dancer does to an audience prior to the end of the ballet.
It's all in your eyes. It's a simple gesture. It's a look. We do coach it quite extensively, probably more than the duets. I mean, because it really has to be right. I mean, it's up to interpretations. I'm not, you have to do it this way, but I mean, there's musicality that they have to have. And, you know, there's interpretations of it to certain points, so they can also put themselves in it, which I find important.
One of the pas de deux, the pas de deux with Armand, I think, and Marguerite, it's really a sweet, sweet, tender pas de deux. And it's just beautiful, absolutely beautiful. Is there anything special about the way you approach that pas de deux and doing that dance?
It's hard. It's one of those things where, you know, out of sight, out of mind, where I don't remember a lot of times when I create works. Mm-hmm. And then I come back to them, I go, did I do that? So many times I really forget, you know, the process and how it's done. And then usually that means it went well. There was no horrific or thing going on. And I do remember creating it on, you know, for the couple at Ballet Florida. And it was pretty special. She was on the verge of retiring, and he was a younger, up-and-coming dancer in the company, which is apropos. It really did work. And in one of the most incredible partners in ballet at the time, even, even at his age. So it was great seeing him being careful with her and vice versa. So it really, on those two personalities that it was created on, really did shape the way. And that's how I work.
Usually. And that really does describe it best.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
And I assume that's the sort of dancers you're looking for.
Right.
When you're your archetype for the various roles. Marguerite is somebody who's probably at the pinnacle.
The world. Yeah. They may be even the same age, but it's where they've been or they haven't been. And in Louisville Ballet that just did it, created with the major ballerina there, but I decided to put a younger, up-and-coming, one of their male dancers that was wonderful, but he's never done a full length like this before. And it was magical. It totally worked. And she took care of him and vice versa. I went back in time a bit there.
Interesting, because you get a young dancer who's working with the prima ballerina who's not used to it.
Yeah,
you know,
that
so
can be intimidating.
Yeah, and it can also be sort of like, you know, I'm not gonna step on any toes here.
Life imitates art in this case. Uh-huh. It's very much the characters.
Is there any other sort of characters that you look for within the archetype of the ballet?
Well, of course, the Baron is probably the villain in this, but of course, she had many suitors of that stature throughout. But in ballet, you don't have, again,
the
magic
time.
Of words.
Yeah.
So I condensed that villain in one person, basically. Olympe, who becomes her rival, you know, the jealousies, and I want what you have, and I mean, there's developing that. And the father is so important. That's a catalyst of him coming in, of telling her, you know, you have to stop seeing my son for various reasons. And that totally turns the story. So that duet between the father and Marguerite is so important. It's probably one of the most important duets in the ballet.
And that's kind of a weird thing to convey without words.
Yes. And I hope I did it. It's one of those things. But that wasn't easy. It's easy to do, not easy, but easier to do, the ingenues, the duets. I mean,
love, betrayal, envy, jealousy.
Yeah, but how do you do a duet between the father telling this woman that she cannot see her son and you can't talk about it? It's all physical. So yeah. That was a challenge. And that has developed over the years, too.
And, of course, in the old days, it would be pantomime. But now that's sort of, that's old school.
It is old school.
Anyway, my guest today is Val Canaparoli, a choreographer for Tulsa Ballet's production of Lady of the Camellias, which returns to Tulsa Ballet this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Still a character dancer at San Francisco Ballet, and I know one of the things you're looking ahead to is doing a new Cinderella.
Christopher Wheeldon.
Yeah, and probably doing one of the...
Who knows?
The stepsisters, or maybe...
I played every creature on the planet, so I'm prepared.
The stepmother, yeah. But Val has done over 75 ballets, and several of them here for Tulsa Ballet over the years, and he returns to Tulsa Ballet. Well, you mentioned earlier that you shaved quite a bit of time off this ballet.
Right.
What sort of things, when you actually see the ballet on stage, you go, oh, I don't need that to tell the story?
Right.
Give us a sense of what you shaved.
In many... many ways, it was shaped by the choice of music, which Chopin, which was chosen before I even arrived on it, and I kept that. But I was a music major before I was a dancer, and I'm really cutting music too much makes me cringe. I know I did it, but I made sure I'd help, in many ways. And there are sections, particularly the second act, where I just cannot, in my own conscience, cut this music anymore. And so over the years, I didn't know what to do because it really, I had to condense it. I've said it already. And it would have been better for the ideas, again, like I said, be condensed. And it took me this year to go, just change the music, different Chopin. And the idea came up and it worked brilliantly. I kept the choreography, but it was shorter. So from probably 13 minutes went down to 4. And it really did tell the story, even more poignantly towards the end of Act 2. And that was a great revelation. But it's like it took me a while to go, well, then just change the music.
Now,
you can do that. You're the choreographer. But.
And music is such a big part. When I look at your work, it's like everything from Charlie Parker and Django Reinhardt to Uri Kane and Michael Nyman and
crazy stuff,
Robert Moran. I mean, it's you have really broad ears.
Right.
Do you hear a piece of music sometime and you go, oh, this would be perfect, and then all of a sudden the next section comes in and goes, oh.
Oh, yeah. I did a piece for Pacific Northwest Ballet to Michael Torkey. And it was his chamber works, and because I didn't want to do the big sounds because I was going to have a big cast. And it just wasn't working. And I got to a certain point, and I went, you know what? I'm going to do something with the dancers. I took a different score from Torkey and told the dancers, all right, don't even flinch. I'm going to put in different music by the same composer. Just do the choreography, I said. And we all afterwards started laughing because it worked brilliantly. If I had originally choreographed to this huge score, it would have been different, but I didn't. And so it was a little bit against it, and I loved it. And so we switched the music over. I mean, you just never know.
That's mind-blowing. Now, I'm trying to get my head around it. You choreograph so the beats are, and I'm sure the second piece of music, it may be the beats may be close, but they're not going to be the same.
Well, then we just, after a while, they just sort of did it on their own, and they're even shocked and surprised that it worked. But then after that, then we started rephrasing things and prolonging or cutting or shortening or different breaths, whatever, but it still worked. It worked even better.
Now, how do you go about and restage something like that? I don't think has that piece been restaged since?
Definitely. I think it was even done here.
That's right. Torque, right?
Yes. It was, that ballet was performed here. It's been performed elsewhere too. So it has had legs beyond that. So once it was staged, I mean, that's what it was, which is great. Or you have, I did a Shostakovich piece. I was going through the ballet as an abstract piece, And it wasn't the music so much. I went, this is great, wonderful. Then I saw in the paper, it was during the war of Sarajevo, mm-hmm. and this article in the newspaper about the Romeo and Juliet of Sarajevo, and the Muslim woman, Serbian man, trying to escape across this notorious bridge that they were gunned down and on this bridge, and they couldn't get to them for a long time. So they were dubbed this, and I went, wow, Shostakovich. This piece was dedicated to the victims of war, and I went, they just clicked, and I shifted.
You had to have a program.
Yeah, and I shifted in the middle of choreographing it to that theme. So sometimes something else interferes. It's not always just the music.
Mm. Well, we're really excited to see Lady Camellias. So I have to talk about some of your other work. You have a world premiere coming up here in about 2 or 3 weeks.
Yes.
But your most recent ballet, this is another little mind-blowing ballet. Mm-hmm. It's based on the short story, The Lottery. Now, I only vaguely remember reading this and maybe in middle school or something like this, but it seems like it's a story of somebody who wins the lottery and then they're
stoned to death.
But yeah.
It's a short story. It's Shirley Jackson, one mm-hmm. of her most famous short stories, and I've always wanted to do a ballet to this. I mean, the premise is that it's in the late 40s, early 50s, and what she wanted to do is take a modern community in the Midwest and put in a very ritualistic rite, combine it, and what would happen. So she never explains why this woman gets stoned or why this community does it, but it's chilling. It's like leave it to be their father knows best, all of a sudden becomes Rite of Spring, and it is shocking when you read it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remembered this, but I approached the Shirley Jackson estate because my idea is, what would happen on stage if all the dancers did not know, like in the play, in the community, when you're picking the lottery, which one of them was going to be picked to be stoned to death? And what happens is the audience is on it, and I did this thing. They let me do this because I told them it'll always be like the audience is going to see it or read it for the first time every night. The dancers will never be complacent because they start the ballet. They don't know who's going to be brutally attacked at the end of the ballet. It's like the last 5 minutes is a very difficult solo that each dancer had to know. So it worked, and it was shocking to the audience at the end because it takes you by surprise like the story does. Like,
and the actual ballet involves, I guess, the passing of the hat, and you take...
Right. And they all stand in a circle. The iconic thing is the black dot. And so they open the ballots together in a circle, and you open it into the circle. You still don't know if you have a black dot. So each dancer, if you see a black dot, you drop your ballot. And then it's improvised a little bit from then because the community shuns you, even your husband or wife or spouse. That's the last person to shun you. And then it becomes this very ritualistic, frightening solo where the person gets stoned to death at the end, blackout. And there's always a gasp with the audience because it's so unexpected.
And how many performances did you have of this?
They did 2 weeks of this.
Okay.
And I'm hoping that it gets out there even more, that more ballet companies will do it. There's a large interest because the audience and critical response was amazing.
Well, I imagine you could have anything from one of your primas to a core member.
That's the thing. You don't know who's going to be the star. And, you know, you got to have dancers that are willing to do this because it's like coming to the theater not knowing that you're going to do the principal parts in Romeo and Juliet or or Don Quixote, or I'm going to do the lead in Nutcracker. You come to the theater, and then you're chosen, and then 30 seconds later, you have to do it. That, to a dancer, is one of the most frightening things, and it really shows that being frightened, am I going to pick this, you know? And what is great is the audience it doesn't work if the audience isn't in on the concept, and they are. There's an announcement made,
mm-hmm.
And it was great because audiences would come back time and time again because they wanted to see who was going to pick it next. And it's pretty amazing because each dancer has a bit of leeway. You know, it's a little different.
Well, I would also say that it would be interesting for the dancers because your whole profession is about making what is really hard seem effortless.
Right.
You know, and that huge mask that mm-hmm. is put up. Well, all of a sudden,
you strip that away, and audience feels it. It is real. It is not put on. It's like, are you kidding me? You know, many times in their circle, a dancer go, oh, I hope I pick. My parents are in the audience. Or, oh my gosh, my foot's a little bad. Please, God, don't let me pick the, you know, it's, you're going to get, it's always going to be on edge. And it's on edge from the time the curtain goes up until it's down.
Because, and the way they find out about it is not by seeing the black dot. It's how the other dancers react.
Exactly. Oh, and if you don't see that black dot and you don't drop it, you're, that's what's frightening about it.
Well, wow. That is really interesting. And you had Robert Moran, a wonderful composer,
yes.
who was actually composed music for it.
Yeah, commissioned score on that level. And I've worked with him before with Atlanta Ballet on an existing score. So I knew him. I knew him from Philadelphia. I would visit him whenever I worked with Pennsylvania Ballet there. So I knew him well. And so we worked out well together. He is a character. He's great. I mean, really unusual composer, mm-hmm. different.
And I would think that almost needed a commission score because of the drama
right.
of what you're trying to convey.
I've been trying to do this for 20 years. And San Francisco Ballet, Boston Ballet, Pacific Northwest Ballet, every company that wanted it, I went in intentions of doing it, but I could not find the music. Hmm. The concept was so distinct. And then I realized I'm going to have a commission score. So it was Ballet West that stepped up mm-hmm. and went, let's do a commission score. Because that takes, it's financially, you know, mm-hmm. it's a hardship. It's not easy to do a commission score because that takes a lot more money and time and planning. So it was great that Adam Skloot, the new director of Ballet West, was willing to take that extra mile. And I loved every minute of it.
It sounds like it's a great concept. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see it on stage. My guest today is Val Canaparoli. He has a world premiere coming up in just a few weeks with Colorado Ballet. Mm-hmm. How's that going? I assume it's all set.
It's all finished. Uh-huh. Which it was finished very quickly, and much to my surprise. The dancers there were great to work with, great collaborators too. And it's Paul Rudders or Rooters. I can mm-hmm. never remember how it's supposed to be pronounced, mm-hmm. but great score. Based on variations of Purcell.
Mm-hmm. So it's, have you come up with the title yet? Because I know that's the, from ballet company managers.
Yeah.
That's the last thing that happens.
It's called In Pieces. Uh-huh. The score is called Variations in Pieces by Purcell. I believe it's of that nature. But it was commissioned by the BBC in honor of the tercentenary of Purcell's death, mm-hmm. but also the 50th anniversary of Benjamin Britten's Purcell's Guide to the Orchestra. So he was doing two tributes in one score.
Oh, interesting.
So the concept of Purcell's Guide to the Orchestra of, you know, describing the instruments coming in and set in a more contemporary way with themes of Purcell. Mm-hmm. So it's a very unusual score. Unusual.
All right, we wish you great success with that, and we Thank look you. Forward to more collaborations with Tulsa Ballet, hopefully.
So, yeah. Me too.
And meanwhile, you can see Lady of the Camellias this weekend at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center as Tulsa Ballet presents. Lady of the Camellias is the third production? Third or fourth?
For Tulsa Ballet?
Tulsa Ballet.
I think it's about the fifth or sixth. Yeah.
Okay.
It's up there. I lose count, but that's good.
Well, thanks very much for your time.
Great. Thank you.
Choreographer Val Canaparoli speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Tulsa Ballet presents his Lady of the Camellias this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. For ticket details, call 918-749-6006. That's the Tulsa Ballet box office, or visit myticketoffice.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.